Today, in part 8 of the series Building a Marriage, the topic is embracing sexual intimacy. Just what is God's design for marital sex and the sexual relationship? How are a husband and wife to bless each other? And what important lessons can we learn from the Song of Solomon? Here's Pastor Seth.
We are finishing up our message series on marriage. And if you've been with us, we've used the Monopoly cards as sort of pictures, images of each of the different elements about marriage that we've talked about. And we've had usually the one we're talking about today up on the stage, but we've gone ahead and put it up here as the last one. Physical intimacy, sexual intimacy, learning to delight in one another. This is an area that for many couples, it's a large struggle. This is oftentimes where the genders come clashing together. If you didn't know you were really different people before this, you discover this, trying to make the sexual relationship work in a way that's happy for both of you. For some people, this involves a lot of relational pain. And as I share today, I don't want you to hear me that I'm not aware of that. I talked to quite a few people over about 35 years of ministry and probably marriages the most of anything. And I know that there's a lot of pain and struggle with this. What I'd like to do mostly is talk about what the Bible has to say about marriage. Doing that in 35 minutes is a rather daunting task. Please do not think that this is all that the Bible has to say about it. But what I would like to do is talk about the pillars, the important things that we are to remember, that usually when we give these short shrift, it has an effect. When I think about sexual relationship in our Western culture, or historically worldwide, particularly I think about three things where our current culture is errs badly in this. And the first area is that the depersonalizing of the sexual relationship. In our current culture right now, and this has been true for about 20 years or so, there's been a one particular sort of strand that floats through our thinking that equates the sexual relationship as an appetite or a hunger in the physical sense. Just like with food, if you have a food hunger, you go ahead and have dinner. In the sexual relationship, if you have a sexual hunger, then you're supposed to have sex. Well, the depersonalizing of that is often missed. Now, it's not missed for most of you ladies, because you sense that there's something that falls terribly short of the ideal here. And this goes into the second thing that I see in our Western culture, is the trivializing of the sexual relationship. I think partly this is due to ladies who sense that the personalizing of the sexual relationship is sort of getting short shrift, and it's very easy for a wife to feel like a mistress with her own husband, or that she's just being used, or he says he loves me, but what he really loves is my body, or he loves his own sexual needs. And then it's easy for a woman there to sort of make the jump to trivializing his needs, or seeing his needs as childish or selfish. That is a great mistake, which we will talk about. The third thing I see in our Western culture is almost the opposite of trivializing, and I'm going to coin a word for today, the passionalizing, of sex, and making the emotion sort of the big to-do about everything related to this, and sometimes this affects men in certain ways. What I often hear among wives is the thing of, I'm just not in the mood, I just don't feel like it, as if that is the thing that you, the decision maker, in terms of this relationship, is it makes sex about me. Now, guys have their own version of this, and both of these versions of it's really about my needs before your needs is something that God is trying to overcome. All right, so with that background, let's dive in. God's design for marital sex, the sexual relationship is to be a celebration of oneness, a celebration of oneness. By the way, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to take time to develop that a man, it takes a man and a woman, obviously, to make a baby. We talked about that in message number one. I'm just going to assume that for today. A celebration of oneness or a celebration of commitment. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, one of the things I really enjoy doing is I enjoy officiating at weddings, especially with people that I've known or I've had a chance to sit down with and either as friends before they start the process or the beginning of the process. But the wedding itself is such an amazing thing, the celebration of it. You see it, I see it especially, and you see it when the bride and the groom are exchanging their vows. There's just something magical going on there. And when they're exchanging their rings, and then when I now pronounce you husband and wife, there's just magic in the room, not just with the couple, but in the room. The groom may kiss his bride, and you can almost sense this anticipation of the people. And then you have the kiss, and usually there's some amount of humor and laughter to it, a good humor and laughter. And then they turn, present to you for the first time, Mr. and Mrs., and the music starts, and everybody usually just starts applauding wildly. And they stand up, standing ovation. It's a celebration. Now, why are we clapping loudly? We're not clapping loudly just because two people say they love each other. We're clapping loudly because two people have jumped off the high board at the pool. What they're saying is, we have just now closed every back door, every side door, every side window and back window in our relationship. I'm all in with you. And there's something in the hearts of the people where that resonates, where we desire a relationship like that, where somebody will make that kind of commitment. This kind of a celebration of oneness, or as the writer says, becoming one flesh, is something along this line. In every way, legally, emotionally, physically, sexually, rationally, financially, morally, in every way, I'm all in with you. And then the other person is saying the same thing, I'm all in with you. There's something there of celebration. And on the wedding night, that is a picture of this commitment that I will not do this, what we're about to do, with anyone else. It's a picture of the commitment. It's the opposite of the depersonalizing of the sexual relationship. It is the epitome of the personalizing of the relationship, which is celebrated that night and then on the honeymoon. The second thing, the sexual relationship is driven by delighting and blessing the other. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. One of the things that you see in the first two chapters of Genesis is that Adam and Eve were naked and unashamed. What does that mean? Naked and unashamed is something that's typified on your wedding night and during the honeymoon and for all the years when you make love together. And what it means is something like we would say in our culture, I see you warts and all and still love you. I'm still in with you. I see your flaws. I see your weaknesses. I see the things that you would say are weaknesses. I remember hurts and pains that you've caused me, but I'm still in. And the other person is saying the same thing. I see you, warts and all. I see you with your weaknesses. I remember things you've done and words you said that you surely regret. And we've asked each other's forgiveness for. But in spite of that, in spite of the nakedness of who we are personally, we know each other like nobody else. We abandon ourselves to each other. It's the epitome of acceptance. It's one thing to accept somebody that you barely know. That's nice. It's quite another thing to accept somebody you know really, really well. And it's quite another thing to be accepted by somebody that knows you really, really, really well. There's something of that delight that is expressed and pictured when a husband and wife make love. Now, for virtually every couple, the word delight means two very different things to a man and to a woman. It takes a while for us guys to learn that if a woman does not feel delighted in the living room or the kitchen or in general relationally or emotionally, there is not a chance in the world she's going to feel delighted in the bedroom. It takes. Now that seems so patently obvious to you ladies, but for us guys, that is not patently obvious when we begin marriage, for most of us. It takes us a while to learn that and to appreciate that and to see that, that we are very, very different creatures, which we talked about in the early weeks of our series, the need for corresponding gender, and then as we've looked at in the last 2 weeks, masculinity and femininity. And ladies, if also for delight, for your guy, delight for most men happens physically. And if that doesn't happen physically, then the emotional part and the relational part, it's very easy for a guy to wonder, does she really care about me? It's really the same thing. It's just very different arenas. And what happens oftentimes is we get stuck. We say, well, I'm not moving towards you emotionally until you have more concern about my physical or sexual needs. And it's easy for the woman to say, there's no way you're getting sex from me, buddy, until you become more personal in the relationship. We get stuck, we freeze, and things just slowly deteriorate. The life gets sucked out of our relationship. In reality, both a husband and a wife are meant to break through how they see delight and bring delight to the other person as the other person appreciates that. Delighting and blessing the other person, not just me. Third, an important means in deepening commitment. Sexual relationship is an important means in deepening commitment. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife and likewise the wife to her husband. When you hear the word should in the Bible, that usually has moral authority to it. This is not just a good idea. This has some weight to it. This has, think about this. Give yourself to this. This is important. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Now, in our culture today, 2,000 years after these verses were written, that seems very reasonable. But I often wonder when I think about these verses, what these verses must have meant 2,000 years ago in the world that lived then. The idea of the sexual relationship being egalitarian, where both a husband and wife have the same rights and needs for sex from one another. And even in 2,000 years later, in some parts of the world, and even in our Western world, you will still see a double standard regarding the sexual relationship. Oftentimes, I remember growing up, and you would hear things like, "Well, a man marries a woman to be the mother of his children, and later on has a mistress." And there was something sort of hanging in the air, as if that, well, that's just, you know, boys will be boys kind of thing. And Paul said, "No, no, 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 no. You err badly when you do that." There's something of an egalitarian here of both husband and wife, and where each are committed to one another and to no one else. On the inside of your handout, verse 5, Paul says, "Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time." Do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer, then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, this is just an observation. I don't know if I can have a verse and reference that I can say to this. But I will tell you that in talking to, I don't know, maybe 1,000 husbands over the years, there's something that goes on in the heart of a man when he's making love to his wife that's hard to put words to. But that is the place where most of the men I know and have talked to feel like, you really care about me, you really love me, you're devoted to me, and at the same time, there's something that says, this is my girl. Now, you ladies, you wives, you probably may not even be aware of that because we're terrible at verbalizing those kinds of things. Even if we could put words to them, it would be hard for us to verbalize those things. But all I can tell you is there's something magical or mystical that happens in the heart where that happens nowhere else. And if a wife tends to trivialize the sexual relationship, then you do so at your own peril. As he says in verse 5, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, Paul is not saying that if a man, or in the case, a woman, strays, it's because of the other person. But what he is saying is, this is a little bit more complex than that. Two people play a role in this. This is important to remember. And he goes back to the first of this verse, do not deprive one another except for one particular instance. Then the essence of the sexual relationship is giving more than getting. Giving more than getting. If you were with us in the early weeks of our marriage series, one of the things that God uses marriage for is sandpaper of a husband and a wife. And he's using the husband to sandpaper off the self-centeredness of the wife, and he's using the wife to sandpaper off the self-centeredness of the husband. And it should not be a surprise that this includes a sexual relationship. What does it mean for to be more of a giver than a getter in this relationship? Again, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, the likewise the wife to her husband. Paul just sort of speaks there as if it's not just a moral requirement or duty, but of course you would want to do this. Be other-centered. The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife. That may grate on you as you read that verse. And the reason it grates on us is because our self-centeredness is so ingrained that we think about ourselves first in this relationship and then our spouse second without even thinking about it. We just react that way. Verse 5, do not deprive each other except by mutual consent and for a time so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Now, usually one of the things I mentioned a minute ago that the husband deals with, his real question, where does she really love me, usually comes in the bedroom. And oftentimes I hear men say things like, it seems to me that the sexual relationship and my sexual needs, it seems to me, or it feels this way, that it's the very last thing on her radar screen. It seems to me that there are all kinds of other things that are more important than that. Sometimes I just have to get the laundry done tonight. I just have to get the kitchen clean tonight. Now those things may be true. But the effect of that kind of thinking and that kind of relating has a debilitating effect on a man. And I know it's hard for you ladies to appreciate that because we are such different creatures. But I think the equivalent would be something like this. Let's say you came home, ladies, and you had something really important that happened at work. You couldn't wait to share with your husband. What effect would it have on you if he said, you know, I just don't want to talk tonight. I'm just not in the mood. I just don't feel like it. And then went out and washed his car. You say, oh, Seth, well, that's different because that's the physical relationship and the emotional part of the relationship is more important. Well, it is to you. But it's not to him. We are really different creatures. And there's room on both sides here to learn to give in a way that the other person appreciates. Giving relationally as a gift. It's my impression that for us men, this is the part of the giving that for the vast majority of us is if I'm not filling my wife's emotional tank in the living room or in the car driving somewhere or going out on a date or just sitting down to chat, letting her talk about her day, this is where she enjoys so much of her relational emotional tank gets full that then the physical relationship makes more sense. Now I'm speaking human guy language here. Makes more sense to her. She's more interested. She feels more loved. Giving relationally as a gift. It's my observation. Don't hold me to this. But it seems to me that for the most part, and most of the guys I've talked to, that the husband's sexual drive is stronger than the woman's sexual drive, the wife's sexual drive. Again, that may not be universal. But it's almost universal in my 35 years of talking to couples. And I wonder, when I hear that, I wonder if there's not something of God's design in the sexual relationship built into the male sex drive that has a purpose to it. What it does, ladies, is it keeps him moving towards you. What we are tempted to do is, because we don't know really how to meet your emotional needs or relational needs, we tend to mess up, or it seems like you think we keep messing up on this. If nothing else keeps him moving towards you, this will. To move with you towards strength. The second part of giving is giving sexually as a gift. If you're a woman and your sex drive is not as strong as your husband's, or if you're a man and your sex drive is not as strong as a woman's, the thing you don't want to be doing is to see the sexual relationship as something about me and my needs first. The sexual relationship is to be a gift. And it's really to be a gift either way, husband to wife and wife to husband. And this is very different. It goes back to what I mentioned about delight earlier. A man experiences delight through his physical senses, through his eyes, and through his touch predominantly. Now, generally speaking, you ladies experience love more through your emotional senses. That's not to say that, you know, the other things aren't true, but what's predominant is very different approach here of what we appreciate, what brings delight, what the sexual relationship means to us. Now, the last thing I'd like to mention here is from the book of Song of Solomon. Right in the middle of the Bible is an amazing book. If you haven't read it, you might want to read it this afternoon, particularly if this is of interest to you. When you read a book, whenever you read any kind of book of the Bible, one of the ways that you interpret what you're about to read is what kind of literature is it? And if you're reading something like the book of Deuteronomy, you're thinking about moral commandments, and that's how you read it. If you're reading a book like Leviticus, you're reading ceremonial commands or ceremonial law that was given to the Old Testament people. If you're reading the history books like the Samuels and the Kings and Chronicles, you read those like you would read a history book. If you're reading a book like Revelation or Ezekiel, this is kind of allegorical, out the kabuti. And you don't read that like you read history books. If you read a book like Proverbs, you read it as a book of wisdom literature. If you read the book of Psalms, you're reading songs, words put to music. You're reading lyrics to songs. But when you come to the book of the Song of Solomon, what you're really reading is poetry set to music. And what you're really reading is something even more wondrous than that. You're reading a whole bunch of love songs to one another. Husband to wife, young wife to young husband. It is an amazing passage. And as is true with so much of the Bible, we've read some of the verses that are pertinent in the earlier part of this message that are sort of didactic true statements. But the sense of the sexual relationship is really more than all the didactic statements you can put together. There's something of a sense of wonder that just didactic statements by their own, or even a pastor's words as he's trying to communicate this, are just not sufficient. There's just more wonder to this than I think a human being can really put their finger on. But there are several things here I'd like to read excerpts. First, driven by the deepening of the relationship. And as I mentioned, for most of us guys, this is the area that we're having to push ourselves on. Song of Solomon 4, 1 through 7 are the words of the young husband to his young bride. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your words behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Some of these you may not want to use. Your teeth are like the flock of sheep just shorn, coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. Not one of them is alone. In other words, she doesn't look like a jack-o'-lantern. Your temples behind your veil are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with elegance, on which it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. Now, I hope that what you sense is something of this man is not just thinking about body parts. He is with his bride, and he is thinking about the whole person. The relational aspect. He's trying to meet her emotional needs as he speaks words to her. Now, this is good stuff, both in the bedroom and in the living room. Chapter 5 gives a picture of the young bride. And here, I hope what you sense is something of her other-centeredness and humility as she relates to her husband. My lover is radiant and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is purest gold. His hair is wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in milk, mounted like jewels. His cheeks are like beds of spice, yielding perfume. His lips are like lilies dripping with myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with chrysolite. His body is like polished ivory decorated with sapphires. His legs are pillar of marble set on bases of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as its cedars. His mouth is sweetness itself. He is altogether lovely. This is my lover. This my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Now, what's hard to put into words is something of the wonder of what each of them are sharing with the bride and groom. But what you sense is something of an amazing other-centeredness and a humility, and that the needs of the other person are more important than what I'm getting, my needs. This is what God is trying to drive into us as husbands and wives down through the years. On the back of your handout, I want to finish with one other thing about Song of Solomon. The book for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, as theologians have studied this, there's been sort of a question of, well, the two people, this is about their love relationship and their honeymoon and courtship and all that, and there's plenty there. But is the book also suggestive of how God thinks about his people? And you have plenty of verses in the Old Testament and the New Testament that describe something of the wonder of how God looks at his people. And one of the metaphors is that Christ is the groom and that the church is the bride. And there's one sense in which that's true now, and there is a much fuller sense in which that sense is coming. In Revelation 21:2, there's sort of this image, same kind of image, but it relates to where we're going in heaven. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And the illustration here is that the place where we're going as God's people, to heaven one day, has been adorned with the same kind of care that a bride gets on her wedding day. She goes and has her hair done. She has her makeup done. She's got all her best friends there. Her mom is usually in the room. They got flowers. Somebody brings something to munch on and something to chew. And it's just kind of this all of this preparation, important preparation, making the bride as beautiful as she can be. Now, what's true about heaven is also true about God's work in his people. He's doing the same thing with you and me, and he will continue to do that all the days of our life. In Revelation 22:17, this is not on the PowerPoint, and it's not in your outline, but it might be worth writing down the reference. Revelation 22:17. Says, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, and the bride, meaning God's people, say, come to Jesus. Come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who wishes to take the water of life without cost come. The idea is something of the wonder that we have a husband who's coming for his bride. As you think about the book of Song of Solomon, I think about the imagery of love letters. Husband to wife, wife to husband. I remember reading the Burns in English class in the love poems between them. There's something in this Song of Solomon of poetry, lyrics, wonder, sort of the sweep of the love relationship. And in this particular sense, this is also true. It's sort of the echoes or a shadow of what's coming, I think is suggested in this book, that this is what God is doing, and he's preparing for us in the same way, in such a way that the language we see in the book will be the language he talks to you about and me about when we're in heaven. One of my favorite children's stories is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And if you've read the book or seen the movie, you know about the mystical land called Narnia. And Narnia is a land where all the animals talk. But Narnia is under the rule of the evil queen, Jadis. And it's always winter there when the children show up. And you have the dark fog of winter where you can't see the sun. And the snow is all over the ground and ice hangs from the trees. And it's just kind of a grim, dim, gloomy place. And the children show up, and over the course of the story, finally Aslan, the lion, comes, who's a picture of Jesus Christ and what he is, the incarnation into this world and what he brings. And as Aslan comes, winter slowly ends. And what happens is spring comes. And you see the thaw beginning, or the ice beginning to thaw. The snow beginning to melt. The fog begins to dissipate and the sun breaks through. The flowers begin to come up from the ground and bloom. The birds are singing and the animals who can talk are singing and chanting and cheering the joy that Aslan has come and that life is very different. Now, that same language is used in Song of Solomon chapter 2, I think, suggestive of the winter here that we are in is going to come to a close. And springtime is coming. Chapter 2, verse 8. Listen, my lover, look. Here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. My lover spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter is past. The rains are over and gone. All of the things that make this life difficult and hard, all of the challenges that you just wish we didn't have to go through, winter is finally past. The rains are over and gone. Flowers appear on the earth. The season of singing has come. The cooing of doves is heard in our land. The fig tree forms its early fruit. The blossoming vines spread their fragrance. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one. Come with me. That's coming. And the language suggests something of desire and delight, that your presence brings him delight, and that his presence will bring you delight. And there's something of not just enjoyment, but euphoria that is illustrated or to be illustrated in the sexual relationship. Let's pray together. Father, there is just so much wonder about this that we just ask you to speak to our hearts. And whatever our need is. I suspect for a lot of us, there's a kick in the seat regarding our self-centeredness. It seems to me like that's always needed. And yet it's a kick in the pants that's not discouraging. We've had that kick in the pants before, and it's moved us in the right direction. There's a sense of wonder about your design and embracing the wonder of it without having to have all the details nailed down. There's something of the wonder of the gift that you have given us and the gift that we have to give to our spouse. There's something about the joy and delight of relationship that should push us forward. And lastly, Father, would you give us a fresh sense of what's coming in heaven? The kind of joy and delight that echoes in this chapter and in this book of Song of Solomon, that would deepen our hope. And that there would be something in us that would know with conviction the best is yet to come.
We at Pacific Church of Irvine invite you to join us every Sunday at 9:30. You can also visit our website at pacificchurch.com.